Welcome back to This Green Earth on KPCW. I'm Renee Bodley-Miller, filling in for Chris Cherniak and Nell Larson. Because they are both off today, I get the privilege of bringing you this best-of edition of the show. Up next, a discussion from last September. Tangier Island is a 1.3-square-mile spit of land in the center of Chesapeake Bay's widest point. It's over an hour's journey from the mainland by boat. About 400 deeply conservative and religious people live there year-round. They make a living on the crabs and oysters that populate the surrounding waters. Yet the number of female crabs is dropping, roughly 70% in the past 6 years. And worse, the island has been shrinking in size for decades. Due to rising water levels, it will literally disappear in the next 40 years. So, should the island be saved? If so, what should be done? Who pays for it? And what precedent does that set for other coastal communities facing rising seas? Journalist Earl Swift spent 14 months on the island. He chronicled his experiences in his new book, Chesapeake Requiem, A Year with the Watermen of Vanishing Tangier Island. Here's that conversation.
Earl, thanks so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Chris, Nell, thanks so much for having me.
Great. I thought we would break the conversation down into roughly thirds. The first third, we'll get some history and some background on Tangier Island, and then we'll move forward and talk about some of these environmental and perhaps cultural and economic challenges the island is facing, and then perhaps delve into some of the potential solutions. So first, Earl, if you could, give us a little, our listeners out here in Park City, Utah, a little background on what and who Tangier Island is.
Okay, this is a squiggle of marsh and mud, 12 miles from the nearest mainland port. It's been settled since 1778 and is now populated by about 460 people, all but a few of whom can trace their lineage to the first settlers who arrived in the 18th century. It's essentially treeless. It's about a mile by three. Most of that, 70% or better, is salt marsh, which floods twice a day with each high tide. Hmm. And it is as close to being an amphibious place to live as you can probably find in the lower 48. Most of it fails to clear 3 feet above the tides. Hmm. Actually, most of it fails to clear one. It's being salt marsh.
Wow.
But even the parts of the island in which you could put up a house are just barely above the water. It's wafer thin. So it's a place that does not have a lot of elevation to give up. And since 1850, it's given up quite a bit. It's not only is the bay around it rising, as are these around the world, but the island itself, along with the entire southern Chesapeake, is subsiding. The Earth's crust there is sinking into the mantle. And that 1-2 punch of land going down and water coming up has spelled big trouble for Tangier and predictions that it will have to be abandoned within 25 years.
Wow. And give us a picture of the economic scene on the island. How do people make a living?
Well, it's all tied to the water, as you would expect. Historically, Tangiermen have relied on the bay and its bounty of crabs in the summer and oysters in the winter for their sustenance, and continue to do so. That is the number one source of income for the island to this day. An increasing number of islanders have decided to forego the uncertainties of crabbing and oystering and have joined the crews of tugboats that are parts of companies that are well off the, well away from the island. They're at opposite ends of the bay in Philadelphia and down in Hampton Roads. And so those folks are gone for weeks at a time. Otherwise, there's a nascent tourist industry, but the income from tourism winds up in relatively few hands, and so you really can't call that a viable way for the island to earn its keep.
So the Chesapeake in general seems to have suffered a number of insults, let's call them, over the decades. high nutrient loadings leading to algal blooms, and then the knock-on effects to, in this case, crabbing and oyster industries. Has the island kind of weathered, or you know, the Tangier watermen weathered those challenges, or do they face similar challenges now?
You know, I think that if you were to ask most of the bay's regular users, you'd be told that that it's looking better in the past couple of years than it has, you know, for many years prior. It's turbidity is way down. The water's clear. Underwater grasses seem to be healthy. The crab population has been very robust for the last couple of years. Oysters have bounced back from the brink of extinction just a few years ago.
Right. We can talk a little bit about that, some of the diseases that the oysters confronted. Was it Dermo and I think it was MSX?
MSX.
Yeah.
To microscopic parasites that really did a number on the population, and you know the oyster population in the Chesapeake was almost inconceivably vast back at the time of the Civil War, say, and became the target of just a pillaging during the late 19th century, and the bay was plundered of its oyster population. And so overfishing had been a problem for 75 years by the time these microscopic nasties showed up to seemingly finish the job that oystermen had started. And it was, you know, it looked in the early 80s like the American oyster in the Chesapeake Bay was doomed to completely disappear. It came close. It came very close. And it's only in the last few years that scientists have detected a resilience, the species has evolved, it appears, not uniformly and not everywhere in the bay, but there are places in the bay where the species appears to be evolving defenses against these predators that are, you know, that they're passing down to their young. And the oyster has made such a comeback that Virginia has reopened its wintertime wild oyster dredging fishery, which if you had asked people 30 years ago what the prospects of that were, I think they would have told you were dreaming.
Right. So let's talk a little bit more, too, about a little more background about the people on this island. You say they've been populated this Tangier Island since the 1700s, correct?
1778.
And, yeah, where was their origin? Or what was it?
Well, they were from elsewhere around the bay, most directly. I guess most of the islanders can probably trace their lineage to Cornwall. That seems to be where a good many of them, their family trees, you know, hail from. But the first guy who settled the island was a man named Joseph Crockett. Showed up, built a house on one of the three parallel ridges of sandy loam that rise almost imperceptibly from the marsh on Tangier. And his grandchildren are really the wellsprings for the rest of for the population today. His granddaughters, in particular, moved onto the island with their husbands and different parts of the island, and you can still see their names, their surnames reflected. That the men they married were Parkses and Pruitts, and those are the two big names now. Joseph Crockett himself, his name is the third most abundant on the island. So it's a place. It's one big extended family.
Yeah,
and that has never changed. It's always been that way. Now, what has changed is that in the last, since the 30s, really, the last 80 years, the population has steadily declined, and it has reached kind of a crisis today, insofar as it's now a pretty old population. The median age is in the mid to late 50s, and you've got a lot of islanders in their 80s and 90s, no young people staying. very few islanders of childbearing years remaining on board. And so a demographic collapse is looming along with the island's physical dilemma. And so, it's every bit as bad, you know, troubling and vexing as that physical dilemma is.
Right.
So, Earl, what about you? What drew you to this island? You spent 14 months there. And how were you received by the local population?
Well, this is a population that has been a curiosity for journalists for more than a century. And so Cairngermen have become pretty savvy in dealing with reporters over the years. And I think that for probably the first month I was on the island, they assumed I was there to do what most other reporters do, which is show up, spend a couple of days on the island, and leave, and write essentially the same story that every other reporter who's ever been there has written, talking about how quaint and lost in time the place is, making note of the odd pattern of, you know, style of speech that islanders have, which is a product of their isolation. And it probably took a month, 6 weeks for them for them to slowly come to the realization that, well, no, wait, I wasn't going anywhere. I was sticking around, and to kind of change to recalibrate their dealings with me. I was spending the same time just kind of showing my face around the island, going to church four times a week. It's very close to a working theocracy of old Methodism, and so going to church is absolutely essential to understanding how the island ticks. But very few reporters spend the night on the island, let alone spend a Saturday night and all day Sunday there, so that you can go to church, and they miss out an awful lot of what's necessary to understand the place. I mean, you're on an island in the middle of Chesapeake Bay. Most everything about your day is beyond your control. You're subject to the whims of Mother Nature to a degree that most of us on the mainland can't fathom. So no surprise that the Cairngermen have relied on faith for their entire existence there, really, to get them through the day. And it's an extremely important element of island society.
We're speaking with Earl Swift. He's the author of the new book, Chesapeake Requiem, A Year with the Watermen of Vanishing Tangier Island. And in addition to going to church four times a week, I'm sure you were out on the water experiencing crabbing and oystering too.
I did both. Crabbing is much more agreeable weather-wise, I'll tell you that. to go oystering in mid-December when the wind's blowing at 35 miles per hour and you're in 4-foot seas and spray is coming up and freezing on everything it touches. That's an acquired taste that has you liking that. I never acquired it, but I found it fascinating in crabbing, perhaps even more so, because they're interesting animals. They're strange creatures.
Right. So let's now turn our attention to the challenges. You cited some of them, the cultural challenges that the younger demographic is moving off the island. Although at times they've had biological challenges, let's call them, with disease or so, or water pollution, that seems to be on hold right now or improving. But the biggest challenge the island faces is its physical disappearance, which is either occurred, depending on who you talk to, it seems, either a function of sea level rise or simply ongoing erosion of the island. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, if you were to speak to a scientist, and I mean just about every scientist on the planet, there would be no disagreement as to what's going on. What's happening is a product of sea level rise. It is erosion, but these are not mutually exclusive phenomena. They're interlinked. The bay has been on the rise for a long time. There's a point of inflection, if you go back and you look at erosion on the Chesapeake and land loss on the Chesapeake, there's a point of inflection that occurs right around 1850, right at the midpoint of the 19th century. Something happened to accelerate the process. And beginning then and accelerating all through the rest of the 19th century, moving into a gallop during the 20th, and now moving at breakneck pace, this process of sea level rise and a resulting ferocity in the erosion that occurs on the bay has claimed land at an ever more alarming pace. And what you see on Tangier is an island that is three times the size it is now in 1850. Lost an average of 8 acres a year since then. Did not have a lot of acres to begin with.
Right.
But now it's down to an area, if you were to include all of the outlying islands and marshy islets, it would be a little smaller than New York Central Park. And all the buildable land on the island, the ridges, as they're called there, these sandy loam ribs on which houses are built, kind of constitute an island within the island, because they're the only high and dry land you can you can actually occupy. Those would all lump together be significantly smaller than the reservoir at the middle of Central Park.
Okay.
Wow.
We're not talking about a big piece of land.
Right.
And as the water comes up, as the island's relationship to the water shifts, not only because of that sea level rise, but because of the island's subsidence, which is a byproduct of the last ice age, we're just going to see, if you were to chart what's happening, if you were to chart land loss at Tangier and elsewhere, this is not a straight diagonal line. It's a parabolic curve. It gets worse as you go.
Wow.
And so we're seeing possibly the end times for the island, unless some truly heroic intervention is undertaken to try to halt it.
Now, the islanders have a different take on what is happening to their island, right? Rather than climate change and sea level rise.
They see it as strictly erosion, and they point to the loss of islands in the 19th century as evidence of that view. They say, hey, well, look, there wasn't sea level rise way back in the 1880s when Holland Island started to disappear. And the fact is, well, yeah, there was. We didn't call it that at the time. We didn't recognize it as such. But if you go back and you look at the evidence that was gathered at that point and you view it in the context of what we know today, heck yeah, there was sea level rise. Not nearly at the rate it's occurring at now, but it was happening. And again, there is a point of inflection in the mid-19th century at which you really see this process kick into gear. And whether that's because that period coincides with the Industrial Revolution really getting underway in a profound way, or whether it's the end of the Little Ice Age that figures into it, which lasted a few hundred years and wrapped up at the beginning of the 19th century. Whatever you ascribe it to, the numbers suggest that's about the start for the processes that we're now seeing moving at a breakneck pace.
Right.
You point out that over the past four centuries, more than 500 islands have disappeared from the bay, and about 40 of them were once inhabited. So this is far from the first island to kind of face this set of problems.
Well, of course, not all of them were abandoned because of sea level rise.
Right.
There were some that people just found too lonely and forbidding to live on. But
understandable.
But you bet. If you look around the bay, Holland Island's a great example. It was home to, 231 people in 1900. The erosion from the west, wind-driven waves, of course, helped along by the fact that the water was on the rise, tore away one of the ridges on which people had built their homes. Folks either abandoned the houses or they picked them up and barged them to the mainland or elsewhere. And with that huge piece of the population removed, Holland's economy imploded, and it prompted everybody else to leave. So that we went from 231 people in 1900 to zero by 1919.
Right.
And you see that sort of thing again and again all around the bay. Well, visible from Tangier, 4 miles away, is Watts Island, which once had 20-odd houses, a church, a store. And I visited Watts when I was on a kayak trip around the bay in 1994. And it took me about an hour to walk its perimeter. It took me a good long time. And I saw no signs of its past habitation. When I went back to Tangier to live in 2016, I was astounded to see that Watts had shrunk to about a third of its size in 1994.
Right.
And it's going fast. You can almost see it get smaller by the day.
So
you know, this process is, it's going to play out on the Chesapeake in a very short amount of time.
Okay, so now let's transition there to potential solutions. What would the islanders like to see happen to, in effect, save this island?
Well, they are facing, as with almost with each day that passes, Chris, the solution would have to be more heroic. I think they would love to see a wall built around the entire island, a riprap armoring of the island's edges, and then they'd like to see dredge spoils pump into the island's interior to raise its level and buy them a century or more of continued existence. And, you know, that's certainly technically feasible.
Mm-hmm.
Financially, however, it's a tough sell. Insofar as you've got 460 people living on the island, and that number is dropping. And that the price tag for such an operation would run into the hundreds of millions of dollars. And there is a proposal on the table. It's a long shot, and I think the Corps of Engineers, which developed this concept, would admit to you that it's a long shot. But rather than save the island for people, which the Corps of Engineers might not be able to justify,
mm-hmm.
There's a chance that they could possibly try to save it for wildlife as habitat being worth more financially than the infrastructure of the town. And if that happened, if they were able to save the island that way, it's possible that they could save the town as a byproduct of saving the birds. Whether they're able to pull that off is a question mark. It's got to go through a lengthy and iffy process,
right,
to win approval and funding.
Well, they haven't had any success, say, with the Army Corps of Engineers under previous administrations. So they actually have much more faith, let's call it, in this current administration and this president, who they supported heavily, being very conservative town. And they believe that this president could, well, in effect, build them a wall.
Well, they certainly hope that's the case. They voted for him to the tune of 88%. I mean, of the 253 votes cast, 221 of them were for Donald Trump. And they did so, despite any concerns they might have had about his personal peccadilloes. They saw him as a guy who could cut through red tape that they felt had mired every promised attempt by the promised effort by the Army Corps of Engineers to come to their rescue. And they figured, hey, here's a guy who knows how to build, is successful in business, can ramrod a solution through so that we're not, waiting for a wall and treading water at the same time. They remain very much Trump supporters.
Mm.
And ever hopeful that he will personally intervene on their behalf.
Right.
Is there an element of faith in this as well? You know, you talk about the deep faith of the population, the community that lives there, and how they they see that their faith has gotten them through other hard times. Do you think that there's an element of that with this this idea of saving the island?
Well, I don't know if it's directly related to their support of Donald Trump, but yes, of course, they see themselves as an anointed people, because if you look back through Change Your History, there have been instances upon instances where, by all rights, the island should have been wiped out. I mean, there was a terrible hurricane in 1821. There were outbreaks of various pestilences throughout the 19th century that should have laid the place low. Of course, a host of hurricanes in the 20th century as well that have really leveled some knockout punches on the place.
Mm-hmm.
And each time, the blow has been just shy of that necessary to keep them down. And so they've come to see themselves as anointed by their faith, armored by the power of prayer. They firmly believe that, and they see themselves basically in God's hands yet again here. And they are confident that they will be saved, that their prayer will see them through once more. And whether the agent of that salvation is our current president or the Army Corps of Engineers or whomever, they are confident that it will occur.
Well, after spending 14 months there with these islanders, obviously developing relationships with them and kind of immersing yourself in their culture and daily lives, I know you need to remain objective, but do you feel like this is an island that's worth saving? Because that's a big question, Earl, because there are many coastal barrier islands around the country that are confronting the same issues at different scales and different rates. But is this an island that is worth saving?
Well, that's the whole ball of wax right there. I mean, the fact is that we have 88,000 miles of shoreline. A lot of it is going to be imperiled in the next few years.
Right.
And Tangier is just the first of perhaps thousands of coastal communities that are going to find themselves in this situation. It's the canary in the coal mine. So this is not an isolated case. It's an isolated case right now, but this is something that's coming to a neighborhood near you very soon.
Right.
Now, we know that we don't have the time, the money, or the technical means to save all of the places that will be imperiled. So we have to develop, as a people, as a country, a rubric for deciding that very question you ask: what's worth saving? What do we value? What's important to us?
Mm-hmm.
It could be that we do it strictly on the basis of headcount, which would doom an awful lot of smaller places that we consider important, as Americans, that have been key to our history or that are key to our culture, or that we just like, that we, for whatever reason. Places like Jamestown or Yorktown.
Right.
Any number of places like that. Any beach resort, you name it. It's part of that. It's going to be one of those smaller towns that will bite the dust if we decide we're only going to save places with a certain critical mass of human presence. So we have to develop this yardstick we have to come up with a way to quantify value, quantify importance.
Right.
And and it's going to be an ugly process. Deciding what to save won't be as hard as deciding how to decide, and it's going to require much smarter people than me. So should Tangier be saved? I don't know. Do I love the place? Would I love to see it saved? Of course.
Yeah.
Unique is a word that we throw around a lot, but this is truly a unique place in the American landscape. There is no other town like it. There's no other. It's developed its own language, for goodness sake. I think that it would make us a little less interesting as a country to not have it helping to define the outer limits, the breadth of what it means to be an American.
Well, the name of the book is Chesapeake Requiem, A Year with the Watermen of Vanishing Tangier Island. The author is Earl Swift. And Earl, thanks again so much for taking the time to join us. Do you have a website or a blog you want to pitch?
Well, my website is earlswift.com.
All right.
And you can find all my books and other stuff there.
All right. Perfect.
Fantastic.
It's a great book. Interesting, fascinating read. And thank you again so much for taking the time to chat
with
us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right.
Really appreciate it.